is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Speaker Boehner adds his job's pitch to Obama's. Is it all smoke and mirrors or worse?
House Speaker John Boehner added his 2 cents to the pot of job creation plans when he called for a total reform of the tax code, fewer federal regulations, and an expansion of infrastructure projects and domestic energy production. Boehner's plan targets the employer side by lowering the corporate tax rate and rolling back environmental and, what else, labor regulations.
And meanwhile, Obama's plan focuses partially on the employee side of the equation, with payroll tax breaks and extended unemployment insurance, more infrastructure projects than Boehner wants, and aids to states for education jobs. We'll dissect the respective proposals, see the prospects of either plan to put America back to work, and comment on Obama's deficit reduction proposals, which he submitted to Congress.
And Medicare and Medicaid, ooh, on the chopping block scares the hell out of me. Well, now we speak to Timothy Canova, professor of international economic law and the author of many, many books, but in particular, we'll just say The Federal Reserve We Need and The Legacy of the Clinton Bubble.
Nice to be with you.
Timothy, $447 billion that Obama is proposing for job creation. What is this for? Is it enough in terms of total money? Is it enough in terms of the composition of the plan and what really needs to be done?
When the plan was first floated, the figure of about $300 billion was first raised, which seemed rather low considering we have a $14 to $15 trillion a year economy that's really somewhat dead in the water right now. So the final plan that President Obama offered raised the total level to $447 billion, which is certainly getting us closer to avoiding a double-dip recession and getting a little bit more growth when you look at the total number. But then when you look at the composition of it, it is a lot more of the same that has not worked very effectively for the past 3 years. $175 billion of this is a cut in the payroll tax. $65 billion is a payroll tax holiday. The idea is that this would put money in the hands of consumers who would then presumably go out and spend it, and hopefully that would create demand for American goods and services. Quite often, the money doesn't get spent fully in the United States. It might stimulate imports from China and elsewhere. It might be hoarded. It might be used to pay down debt. Another part of the Obama plan is a tax credit of between $5,600 and $9,600 to encourage the hiring of veterans. When you think, what is the cost of hiring somebody? It's a lot more than $9,600 a year. So, again, it's not the most effective type of stimulus. There are some aspects of the jobs proposal that I think would be effective, $35 billion to state and local governments to prevent the layoffs of an estimated 280,000 teachers, police officers, and firefighters. And then, of course, there's the National Infrastructure Bank proposal, which would be a $10 billion infrastructure bank, plus another $50 billion in immediate investments in roads and rail and airports and waterways, and $30 billion to retrofit public schools. Those direct payments, the $35 billion to help prevent the layoffs of teachers and firefighters and police, and then these infrastructure investments, that's certainly the right way to go, but politically speaking, much of that might just be dead on arrival.
I just want to back up a little bit. One of the things that has always hit me is this impending sense of doom now. We are in a state of decline as a manufacturing center. Is it possible, really, for there to be massive jobs created without a meaningful manufacturing sector, or what needs to be done then to really develop the kind of sectors that are going to create jobs, or is it just entirely in the government service, really?
Well, we've lost a couple of million manufacturing jobs since the recession of 2007-2008 began. We had lost millions of manufacturing jobs in the decade leading up to the recession. We've lost millions of construction jobs as well. it's hard to imagine recreating the economy the way it was 10 or 15 years ago. And part of the reason is we've had a steady stream of outsourcing for the past decade or more. So why would businesses want to be creating new factories here when they seem to have the green light to just outsource production overseas, production and assembly overseas? That's somewhat problematic. It's hard to imagine a renaissance of manufacturing in the United States without some reforms in our approach to international trade. Unfortunately, the only approaches we hear about international trade, the Obama administration wants Congress to approve several more free trade agreements. And, you know, the free trade agreements we've had in the past has not been a great deal for American workers. And arguably, China's entry into the World Trade Organization more than a decade ago contributed greatly to the decline of American industry and has created this race to the bottom in terms of wages and labor standards and environmental regulation. I don't see how the United States can really compete with that type of a trade regime.
Would devaluing the dollar make any sense in terms of foreign trade, in terms of making U.S. goods cheaper and foreign goods more expensive to us?
Well, in the past year and a half, the Chinese currency has, the Chinese authorities have allowed their currency to appreciate about, I think, about 6% to the dollar. It has made no difference. Our bilateral trade gap with China has only grown. It's not gotten lower. So trying to rebalance our trade situation just by devaluing the dollar has, I think, a lot of dangers involved in that. It would perhaps lead to importing higher prices for goods and services. That could lead the Federal Reserve to try to, you know, hit the brakes on, because they're ever vigilant about inflation. You know, a weaker dollar might make goods produced abroad more expensive here and American goods cheaper abroad, but it could make it more expensive for American companies to set up distribution networks overseas as well. I think it has to be something more than just trying to manipulate currencies. We have moved towards a global trading regime without any kind of effort to have globalized, harmonized labor standards and environmental standards. And that might seem like a pipe dream right now, and I think part of the reason it does is because corporate power has become so big in the United States and abroad that they are undermining labor standards and environmental regulations here in the United States. It's hard to imagine corporate America getting behind an effort to harmonize those kinds of standards internationally.
So what else, if we can't get even the Democrats to do a stimulus package that makes any kind of sense, given that it could be bigger, could the Fed do something if they really wanted to, the Federal Reserve Bank?
The Fed has had two quantitative easing programs, as they've been called, where the Fed essentially purchases financial assets from its banking clientele. And by taking whether they're mortgage-backed securities or treasury bonds off the hands of the banks, they're injecting liquidity or monetary reserves into the banks, hoping that the banks will then turn around and use that money to lend to small businesses in the middle class. And that has not been going so well for the past 3 years. The banks have been sitting with something like $2 trillion in excess reserves. So the Fed is now talking about a so-called Operation Twist. The Fed would sell some of its many hundreds of billions of dollars of short-term treasury securities and go into the market and purchase long-term treasury bonds to push down interest rates, long-term interest rates, not just for the Treasury Department, but presumably it would help push down long-term interest rates for mortgage holders around the country and help encourage refinancing and consumers to spend more money. In the kind of conditions that we're in, with 25 million people out of work or underemployed, you know, such weak labor markets, this kind of monetary policy is just not all that effective. It's quite possible that this Operation Twist will result in lower interest rates on long-term treasuries, but the banks will just sit on yet another $1 trillion of excess reserves and perhaps will not lend it into circulation and instead might use the added resources for derivatives type of investments, gambling. I think the frustration that I feel and that a lot of other economists are feeling that I speak to, is that the solutions that are needed are just politically not viable right now. With 25 million people out of work, the most effective thing the federal government could do right now would be to actually start spending money putting people to work. You know, we've had 4 million acres of land that has been scorched in wildfires in the past few months, and we don't have a civilian conservation corps to, you know, clear underbrush and put out fires. And, you know, this would be very cost-effective. Robert Shiller, a Yale economist, has said it would cost only $30 billion a year to employ 1 million young Americans in a civilian conservation corps. But, you know, again, this is a political non-starter. The Federal Reserve could have a quantitative easing program, I suppose, where it's actually lending money to state and local governments. The Fed claims it doesn't have the statutory authority to do that. If it went ahead and did it without the statutory authority, I doubt anyone would have standing to stop the Fed from doing it. But, you know, realistically, the Fed is not about to do that. And this is what's needed, is a QE3, an easing program for Main Street, for home borrowers, for state and local governments. Those are the ones that have really felt the pinch of this downturn in the last 3 years. And unfortunately, the trend is completely in the opposite direction, where state and local governments are under pressure to be cutting their spending, to try to find more revenues to tax. You know, this is austerity multiplied all over the country for the public sector at a time when the public sector should actually be filling the gap from a private sector that is not hiring and not investing. At the state and local level, there are things that state and local governments could do. They could create their own infrastructure banks. They could create their own commercial depository institutions. I've pointed many times to the Bank of North Dakota. It's a small state, but it's a state that's been in a continual budget surplus throughout this crisis, and it has the lowest unemployment rate in the country. Some people will say, well, it's rich in natural resources, but, you know, you look at neighboring states like Montana, you look at Alaska, these are states with rich natural resources too, but they have very high unemployment rates compared to North Dakota. So North Dakota has this public bank, the Bank of North Dakota, where the state deposits its tax revenues, and the bank lends it out within the state of North Dakota, keeps North Dakota money within North Dakota. So there's been some efforts in that regard. There are about a dozen states around the country that are right now considering similar public sector banking bills, including where I am in California. There's a bill sitting on Governor Jerry Brown's desk. We'll see whether he signs it or not.
Tim, and we are speaking with Tim Canova, Professor of International Economic Law, and this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. I had a chuckle to myself. I was always hoping that the left would reach a point of, class warfare against for redistribution of the wealth. But according to the Republicans, it's the more conservative wing of the Democrats that have launched a class war on the billionaires of this country. I mean, what in the world do you say to that, and how do you look at the proposals relevant to the tax cuts? We've got a new way of looking at billionaires and their job creators. They're not billionaires.
Well, you know, the reality is we've seen a massive redistribution of wealth and income from lower classes, poor and middle class and working class folk, to the very top of the economic pyramid. And we've seen this redistribution going on for several decades now. It has accelerated in the past 10 or 15 years. And I suppose the billionaire class and the Republican Party and conservative Democrats would act as if this redistribution is just the natural workings of a free market. The reality is this redistribution is helped tremendously by the public sector, by the federal government propping up financial cartels and industrial cartels and CEOs all over the country. There's been a lot of criticism of President Obama's fiscal stimulus of 2009, $787 billion stimulus over a 2 to 3 year period, and a very big chunk of that was tax cuts. So really, we're talking about a few hundred billion dollars for fixing roads and bridges around the country. You compare those the magnitude of that type of stimulus with the trillions of dollars, the many trillions of dollars that the Federal Reserve has been showering on a financial cartel. And the distribution of wealth and income that we see is more top-heavy now than it's been since the Gilded Age of the 1890s. It is hard to imagine an industrial economy operating efficiently when the resources, when so much wealth and income is in the hands of a relatively small part of the population. So what should the government be doing now? It should be breaking up the power of these cartels. It should stop subsidizing the cartels. You know, the corporate welfare is just on a scale that is unimaginable. And it should be using fiscal policy, taxing and spending to redistribute resources back to the middle class from the wealthy. You know, the latest proposal by the Obama administration for a tax on millionaires, this the Buffett principle, it's long overdue.
It's no more than a principle, though, right? I mean, it's not. There's no substance to it. The Buffett rule, as they're calling it.
As far as I know, right now it's just a principle. I don't think there's been any legislation introduced in either House of Congress or a legislative proposal of sorts that's, you know, been presented by the Obama administration. So far it's really talking points.
Well, he's talking about the now renewing the tax cuts to the rich, and he's talking about closing tax loopholes. And they were saying about $1.4 trillion over 10 years. I mean, do we need more? Do we need a financial transactions tax? Do we need to tax the rich the way we used to tax them in 1960? Is this anywhere near enough?
Yes, we do need to be taxing the wealthier more than these proposals. And a financial transactions tax would make imminent sense. The Europeans were moving towards that in the past few weeks, and Treasury Secretary Geithner flew to Europe and helped put the kibosh on that. The Europeans are now in a position where they're thinking of trying to move forward with the financial transactions tax without the United States. And, of course, they worry that they would lose all kinds of financial transactions businesses, would flee European jurisdictions that have a tax. So, again, it points to the need to harmonize solutions between countries. But, you know, the Treasury Department, in the hands of Geithner, seems to be a tool of Wall Street, and I think a financial transactions tax, as important as it would be, and this goes back many years, it's been called the Tobin tax at times, after the late Nobel laureate economist James Tobin from the Kennedy administration. But your question is absolutely right on target. You know, we are living in a time where politically, our political system is dominated by billionaires, not just millionaires at this point. It is wedded to this idea that the only way to run a modern economy is with the lowest possible taxes possible. And yet the empirical evidence shows that the economy does much better when there's more progressivity in the tax system. During the Clinton 90s, you had higher taxes on the top brackets, and the economy performed much better. There was not, by the end of the Clinton period, the federal budget was actually in surplus. You could go all the way back to the 1940s and 50s and 60s when we had marginal tax rates for some of that period that were as high as 94%, reduced down to 70% in the 1960s, and the economy performed so much better than it did today, and we were not in the kind of fiscal crisis that's been invented now.
Well, Tim Canova, Professor of International Economic Law, thank you very much for joining us. And we'll continue to check in with you for economic analysis. And maybe we really will have class warfare. I don't even know how to say it anymore. But it'll be directed towards.
Yes, I do.
It'll be directed towards the real redistribution of the wealth to the people who have labored to create it. Thank you so much for joining us.
And now moving from Randy Newman's Mr. President, we go to a subject that Professor Canova talked a little bit about, that of state banks. And we hear from Dr. Roseanne Junker on the Socialist Bank of North Dakota.
The Bank of North Dakota is different from private bank in a very simple way. A private bank takes your deposits and it pays you an interest on your deposit, and then it takes your money and lends your money to someone else and charges someone else more money than it's paying you, and it makes a difference in the spread. A state-owned bank has a different mission. Its mission is not to make a profit. Its mission is to serve the people of the state. It's able to take a really long-term view about what's the right thing to do for the people of the state at this moment in time. Right now, it's a $4 billion bank. It's capitalized with the state's earnings. It is paying interest on that money to the state treasurer, and it's using that money to create different lending opportunities for North Dakota family farms, for farmers who want to diversify, for students who want to go to college. When the Bank of North Dakota was being set up, it had been a state for 30 years. 95% of the people were engaged in farming. It was being, in the grossest terms, ripped off by the interests out of Minneapolis and St. Paul and Wall Street interests. And it was practically impossible to make a living at anything. If you would go to borrow $100 from the bank, you would come back with $68 because they charge you 12% interest and a $20 origination fee. And the farmers were really mad. The opponents of a state-owned bank did everything they could possibly do to stop it from being established. They took two challenges to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said, if the citizens of the state want to do this, they should be able to do it. And then there's a drought in the 1920s, and these farmers just had to see that dream turn sour when they couldn't pay not only the principal, but the interest on the loan that they had with the bank. And people would write notes to the bank on a torn sheet of paper. I would send it to you, but I don't have any. We don't have a crop. I haven't had a crop this year. I didn't have a crop last year. They didn't have money to even feed themselves, much less pay a bank loan. The bank tried to collect the money. The Bank of North Dakota representative would just say, I can't take money from these people. They don't have any. And it became very clear in the early 30s, and this is when Bill Langer was governor, and Bill Langer created a moratorium on debt. So the bank stopped doing any kind of foreclosure and then allowed them to stay on the farms. When the economy turned around in the early 1940s, the bank sold those farms back to the original farmer at the price the bank had in them. The Bank of North Dakota is doing amazingly well, given the worldwide economic crisis that we're in. It's as strong as it's ever been. The fact that it isn't suffering any of the fallout from the financial crisis that the other banks are, I think attests to really the strength of the bank and actually the bank's mission. And they didn't invest in risky derivatives. They didn't buy any subprime home loans. It didn't fit the way that they did business. During the last 90 years, the bank has returned $500 million to the state's general fund. What that means is the state has been able to develop programs, $500 million worth of programs, without taxing the people of the state to do those programs. It really, in my mind, it doesn't matter if it's socialism or capitalism. You know, what matters is what works best for the people, what provides the most services at the least cost.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.